Hi, come join us.
Oh, does everybody have a Bible here?
Sure. How many do you need over there?
My name is Scott Hasserud. I don't know if I've been, I think I've met most of you. And I always enjoy doing this. One of the things I miss at Holden is when I was a parish pastor, I used to have a text study every week on Mondays. And the group would gather, it wasn't a large group, but it was. And we talk about the text for the next Sunday, particularly the text that I was going to endeavor to preach on. And then that group would wonder all week what in the world I would have. Hi, come on in. So I've always enjoyed the chance to do that, and come and join us to see you. And envision this as a discussion of some of your ideas, and I want to I will want to use some of those ideas in writing the sermon for Sunday. So I'll try to give credit where credit is due, and I won't reveal any. Well, let's begin with a word of prayer, shall we? Gracious God, we thank you for this gorgeous day and the chance to be alive and be a part of it and to be gathered here around your word. May this time together be a time of new insight, a time of sharing, a time of learning for all of us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay, why don't we just start in by reading the text together for next Sunday, and if we could get some volunteers here. Would somebody look up Hosea 5, 15 through 6, 6? Who will volunteer to look that one up? All right. And then who would look up Romans 4, 18 to 25? Anybody volunteer for that one? All right. And Matthew 9, 9 to 13 is our gospel text. Anybody willing to? Okay. All right. Good. Well, those are the three texts, plus, of course, there's a psalm, Psalm 50, but we won't read that together today. And well, let's start out with Hosea 5, verses 15 through chapter 6, verse 6.
I'm reading from the RSV.
Okay.
I will return again to my place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face, and in their distress they seek me, saying, "Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn, that he may heal us. He is stricken, and he will bind us up. After 2 days he will revive us. On the third day he will raise us up, that we may live before him. Let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. His going forth is sure as the dawn. He will come to us as the showers, as the spring rains that water the earth. What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Your love is like a morning cloud, like the dew that goes early away. Therefore I have hewn them by the prophets. I have slain them by the words of my mouth, and my judgment goes forth as the light. For I desire steadfast love, not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offering."
Okay. Romans 4, 18 to 25.
I'm not going to try to do anything with this.
Okay? All right.
This is straight reading the text.
Okay. Yes.
RSV, I think. That's good. Maybe it's even a few things. Who against hope believed in hope, that he might become the father of many nations according to that which was spoken, "So shall thy seed be." And being not weak in faith, he considered not his own body now dead, when he was about 100 years old, neither yet the deadness of Sarah's womb. He staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strong in faith, giving glory to God, and being fully persuaded that what he was promised he was able also to perform, and therefore it was imputed to him for righteousness. Now it is not written for his sake alone that it was imputed to him, but for us also, to whom it shall be imputed, for we believe on him that raised up Jesus our Lord from the dead, who was delivered for our offenses and was raised again for our justification.
Okay. And then finally our gospel text, which is Matthew 9:9-13.
And this time reading out of RSV. As Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. And as he sat at table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and sat down with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to the disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard it, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I came not to call the righteous, but sinners."
Okay, well, obviously there's many preaching possibilities in these texts. And some themes that weave themselves through all of them. But I would like to focus or use the gospel text as kind of our basis for our discussion today. And I may also write some things down that you say, so if I'm writing from time to time, please excuse me. Let's begin. Who could tell us a little bit about who was considered righteous and who was considered a sinner in Jesus' day? Do any of you remember a little bit about your history of that period? All right.
The folks who worked for the occupying government.
All right. They were considered sinners. All right. So it wasn't necessarily just somebody who was, you know, did bad things to other people or something, right? There was a whole class of people who were considered sinners.
And everybody knew who was a sinner and who was righteous.
Right.
Is that common? Common knowledge of categories?
Yeah, I think so. That's my understanding, that people knew who fit, you know, in which. Who else was a sinner? Does anybody else remember? What other kinds of people were considered sinners?
People who were impure from anything.
Okay. Such as, and they were considered impure.
Because there's some anomaly about them, like having some kind of disease,
okay,
or not keeping the ritual purity laws about how to eat.
Certainly people like prostitutes. Also considered sinners.
And very likely even women, like during their menstrual cycles and all that.
Thief on the cross.
If you weren't racially pure, were you considered a sinner? Do you know?
Everything that happens before this
like the northern or southern?
Well, like if you were a Samaritan, for example.
No, if the category of sinner would apply to them, we certainly get that sense that there's something. As we talk about this, the question that arises in my mind is whether sinner is a category that is, there are Jews and then there are other people, right? And
right.
There's Gentiles and Jews.
Right.
Are Gentiles, by definition, sinners? And some Jews are sinners.
I would think so. If this is, we have the righteous and then we have sinners, and if all people are one or the other, I would think the righteous would be a small subgroup of the faithful Jews.
So that by definition, anyone who is not a Jew cannot be righteous.
Yeah,
right.
And some Jews are, as
you said. That's right. That's what I would think.
Right.
That's how the logic works.
Right. Well, that's my understanding, was that this group of sinners was rather huge.
The majority.
Yeah, it was the vast majority of people. I've listened to people like Dan Erlander talk about how difficult it was to be righteous, because if you were, most people were relatively poor, for example, vast majority. And therefore, the ability to pay both your temple tax and your Roman tax was literally impossible for the vast majority of people. And naturally, they would choose to pay the Roman tax because... hey, Dee? Dee? Anyway,
sign on the door that says,
yeah, please
keep this door open.
Shut.
No, it says keep the door open.
Oh, is that what it says? Oh,
okay. In case of fire, keep door open.
Yeah. But it had to do with heat in the winter, I think.
Yeah. But maybe we could take it down.
Yeah, we should take it down. What was I saying? Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah, it was, and it was, you know, economically almost impossible for the vast majority of Jewish people to be righteous, because they naturally they'd pay the Roman tax, because if they didn't, they'd end up in jail. And if they didn't pay the temple tax, they wouldn't end up in jail, but they would just be considered sinners. So Jesus really has this incredible audience to appeal to. And that was kind of a new learning for me a while back. I didn't realize. I thought sinners, you know, were just prostitutes and people with, you know, infirmities of one kind or another, because they were considered sinners. But it really was a rather substantial group of people that were on the outside of what it meant to be pure or righteous. But for a rabbi to go and associate with them was a very, you know, controversial thing. It was all right if the sinners were repenting, but for him to, you know, and they came and repented, then, but for him to seek them out was a pretty radical kind of stance on his part. Now, what I'd really like to do, though, is translate this into kind of our own context today. Do we have anyone here who considers himself a sinner that would like to?
Do what we? Is the point about?
Is it right? what does it mean to you to be a sinner? I mean, how do you understand that notion? What does that mean to you? I mean, do you think of yourself as a sinner? And if you do, what does that word mean, or point to, or hold for you, or what do you associate? And there are no right or wrong answers here. I just am curious what you're thinking.
For me, it's unbelief.
Unbelief.
And my prayer always is,
okay,
Lord, help down my unbelief.
All right. How else might we?
I make it more practical, the funny little things I do that I really shouldn't do.
All right.
Especially where other people are concerned.
All right. Yeah, all right.
When I say this, I feel like I'm just being politically correct, but I think I've already come to believe this.
Okay. Well, that's all right, too.
So,
okay.
In addition to the ones that Ray is talking about, the ones that are clearly visible to me that I blew it on, it seems to me that my life is so embedded in a structure that I derive advantages from and other people are hurt by, that somehow there's no way out of that, you know, that there is literally no way for me not to do that.
So there's a system that you are privileged by,
yeah,
that actually And that privilege is created systemically.
And I will say that I got to that one by coming to realize that I was in a system I was disadvantaged by, that I actually came to understand racism and classism, first understanding a much more self-interested one, which was sexism. And when I once began to see that that was kind of a system, it wasn't like there were bad people somehow sitting there messing up things, but rather that it was somehow a whole way that the world related. And I don't think it's capitalism. I don't think it's some simple economic explanation to it. I just think it's a whole structure. And I guess we can extend it even to the structures of how we relate to nature, that somehow there's not a way out of it. So in addition to the things that I do every day that are selfish in a kind of immediate sense, like in my relationships immediately with the people around me, there's this other thing that's always going on.
The sins of Christ spent so much time talking about love. Lack of love or hardening of the heart would be to sin in Christ's eyes.
Because when I think about being a sinner, it's to me very fundamental. I mean, that it's so it's so much a part of me that it's hard almost to say. You know, I can name the manifestations of it.
Okay.
I can say, I'm impatient, I'm this, I'm that. You know, things in my character, things that are my actions, things that are about the world in which I live. And in addition, I can name things about the way the sinfulness of the world affects me, you know, that sometimes it's not that I'm the one who sins, but that I'm, you know, that old more sinned against than sinning, uh-huh. without the more in it, uh-huh. that I can feel ways that, you know, like Linda said, that the system but it's not even the system. The system is itself a manifestation of something that is askew.
Right.
Yeah. And it's almost like, that I'm tongue deaf, and so it's very hard for me to ever match a note. Only if I've sung a song about a zillion times can I get it right. And there's something like that I can know. Sometimes I don't know, and so I get it wrong. And sometimes I know, and I still get it wrong.
That's what Paul said.
And it doesn't. I guess what I'm trying to push at here is that I don't think being a sinner is something that ever goes away. I wish I could remember the title of it. There's a book some woman wrote about the recovery movements. And she said, if you define the human condition as your problem, you have an enormous audience. And I thought, well, isn't that what the church really says? The human condition is the problem?
Right.
You know, and that, so that's what I'm trying to say. Is that the human condition, because I am a human, but it's even more than because I'm a human, because I live in this world, sin won't go away. And it's very fundamental to me. I'm sorry, but on and on.
No, I think that's
hard.
I think that's
grasp.
I think that's important. Say,
can we do a once and not? I was astonished when someone in here, in this very room, this week, equated sin with sexuality, because I will say that I didn't. I don't think I was ever taught in Sunday school that sexuality was sin. I might have been taught a lot of crazy things, but that was not one of them. And now there may be other people in this room who were taught that and who have to work again.
I think that's pretty deep in our culture. It has to do with the, you know, the earth, the body, nature, I don't know, a lot of things being labeled not of God or less than God or not good.
What you hear so often is that, I mean, there's sin, but then sexual sins are really sin.
Yeah,
the worst kind.
Right, there clearly is a gradation to this, even though we claim that God doesn't keep score. Certain kinds of sins are more sinful.
But I think there's also, I mean, I think you're both right, but on the same time, I think that we're also in a transition about that, so that having spent a couple decades maybe saying that sexuality isn't a sin, now we find ourselves in a situation where we need to say, but some kinds of sexual behavior really are. And people are confused about that.
Yeah.
You know, sexuality isn't a sin, but I'm not supposed, but then why are these people getting in big trouble?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think part of the problem there is a dualism that we got from Plato and the Gnosticism, where anything that is really of the earth is, I mean, to be human in the Gnostic sense is to be, you know, to be thinking, rational, reasoning people, and sexuality by its very nature is an earthy kind of thing,
right.
And that simply to be earthy is to be sinful in the same kind of sense as in this text is that, you know, if you're not one of these few righteous folk, then you are a sinner. Well, to be, I mean, and so that, you know, there's been some kind of movement, and Larry Rasmussen's been talking about new world view, which is kind of recovering that we are all part of the world and not separate from it, which should correct then for that view. But then we're left with the, you know, the kinds of injuries and violence that is done sexually between people, which is a matter of sinfulness then.
I almost hear what we're saying is that everything that isn't pure is sin. And that's the bulk of our lives. And I think that's a little too extreme.
Yeah. We're getting caught up in Pharisees.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, I think there's a great relief to be told, to be allowed to say, there are things that aren't working. Also, that this thing about they that would be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. Yeah, if you've been told forever that you're wrong, you can't do anything, maybe that's not the good news to you. But I think in a success-oriented society, to be told, yeah, you know, there's this thing in the world called sin, and the world isn't the best it could be, is a great relief to many people. And especially if you say that and say, and not only that, but here's something that answers it. Not that makes sin go away, but that answers the problem.
Yeah, I think it's a, this may sound really simplistic, but I think it's an incredible relief to discover that you're a sinner. Now, we've all known that intellectually, you know, since day one, right? But to really know that it can be I mean, then I think the grace of God is you're really ready for the grace of God. And so that hopefully where we'll move to here in a minute is maybe some kind of possibility of looking at including sin in our definition of wholeness, as opposed to a dualistic notion that purity exists over here and sinfulness exists over there, that there is such a thing as purity in by itself, you know. But rather, I think there's some other possibilities. But before we get to that point,
Well, just one question to throw into our thing about there. Is there pure sin or pure sinfulness? I just throw that out. Just, huh. You know, talking about purity, I mean, that kind of...
I think there's a way of defining wholeness as that includes sin, rather than excludes. So, but let's think about that in a minute.
I hear what you're saying. When you think of a purely sinful either act or person, is that what you're...
Isn't that a different...
Was that what you're asking?
That's
right?
A different...
The question is it possible to identify that's it. Whatever else this we've been talking about, that one over there.
But that's a different definition of the word pure. if you think of the word pure as being whole, without sin.
Without sin or without...
But is there an unadulterated, as it were?
Is there an act that is just clearly sinful? There's no redeeming possibility in it whatsoever. I suppose, maybe.
But you think of, I mean, and there probably are, I'm not thinking of, but you think of the really ambiguous ones like Judas, you know. Yeah. What if somebody doesn't do what Judas did? Then how do you get the rest of this?
Did God have a plan?
Plan B?
Judas was a part of it.
Or I think we were already on plan B.
Okay, let me... Now the interesting thing that Jesus does to follow the text here, I think, is that he's got all these sinners out there, right? So if we use the text as a kind of a paradigm, a model for how to proceed here, he invites the sinners to dinner, right? And he goes out and he knows who the sinners are and he invites the sinners to dinner. In this case, it's a tax collector. He's clearly a sinner because he's collecting money for the wrong party here, maybe the Romans. But the question that I'd like to ask us, which I think is a fascinating one, what would it mean to invite the sinners to dinner now? And Let's just jump right into it inwardly. What would it mean to invite your sinners to dinner? What would it mean to invite your sin to dinner?
Admission of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Admission.
Yeah. Okay. You'd have to recognize that it existed, right? If you're going to invite it to dinner.
You can name it so you can write the invitation.
Yeah. Okay. Gee, it's a pretty long list.
Okay, I just go out on the highways and byways. I don't need to name it.
Okay.
So there'd have to be an admission, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have to recognize. You'd have to name it, right? You'd have to have a name, I guess. Huh?
And you have to have a judgment.
Okay, all right.
It's meaning you have recognition, but it's also judgment.
That this is a sin.
Sin.
This is something that this is a sin.
From our previous conversation, that shouldn't be hard because anything that isn't pure fits into the category.
Okay.
Well, except you don't believe that, so you're not going to invite those. Is that right?
Well. I may draw the line a little different place.
But whatever definition you have, you have to be willing to apply that.
But there also
is the problem is to apply it.
There also is in the Hebrew meal tradition the setting of an extra place at the table for the unnamed visitor who may come, or for Elijah who says he's coming but never shows up. So there's also, maybe we can have a space in their invitation for our unnamed.
The unknown sin.
Unknown.
Yeah.
Sin.
Yes, that's the thing. What regard in our confession, don't we say, in some of the variations of the confessions, mm-hmm. we confess things we don't know. We don't know that we did.
Yeah, in a way, it's I've always felt it's unfortunate that we lost the confessional booth. I guess we call it pastoral counseling or something like that these days. But
we don't have to go to that.
No. But there was a real sense in which, in the best sense of what that could have meant or might mean for somebody. Obviously, it was trivialized.
When someone comes in for pastoral counseling, they think of it in terms of their sin.
Although I can tell you as a pastor, I used to say people would say, what do you do as a pastor? And if I wanted a quippy answer, I'd say, well, I welcome people into the human race. Because folks would come and they'd say, life and join the rest of us. There is a, So that, in a sense, was a kind of, often is a kind of confessional time. Then we get into, you know, because then they name whatever it is that they're struggling with, or what's bothering them, or their pain is.
I think you do raise a good point. I've been a pastor for over 15 years now, and it's real easy or tempting to, when someone comes, to respond, you know, with psychological tools rather than theological tools. It's a whole lot easier to, you know, be kind of an amateur counselor with that person rather than simply, you know, welcome them in and declare absolution. You know, that's a lot. I remember, what's his name at Luther Seminary, that big Norwegian guy that tells all the funny stories? Jim
Westbury?
Jim Mestigan.
Jim Mestigan.
Jim Mestigan telling about one time that he was doing Ash Wednesday service with the laying out of hands and the absolution, and this one guy comes forward and then starts stepping backwards. So I don't know if you know Nessigan or not, but he picks up his rope, steps over the railing, lays his hand on him, and declares absolution. And there was, you know, that a real release of power in that. But real easy not to actually do that.
Okay, what else? Let's say some more about this. I think this is really it. You know, what does it mean for us to include in our understanding of ourselves, our sinfulness.
I think it's really interesting that in the middle of this meal he switches the metaphor
to the
physician.
Yeah. Verse 12.
Yeah. And then in 13, it's interesting, yes, he's eating with these people, but in the midst of eating with them, he switches the imagery so that it's almost like a bait and switch, you know, come to dinner and then repent. So that, yes, these people are invited, but it's not simply... That inviting somehow changes you. So that to invite those sins to come and eat is to transform them in some way. That you don't just invite them, just don't just make friends and say, oh, this is great. Hey, happy to meet you. Isn't this fun? Because in that regard, it reminds me, I was at a wedding shower once where everybody was supposed to give a little sage saying it. And one of the women said, always allow the other person the vices of their virtues, which suggests that that who we are has both good and bad consequences. And so that maybe many of the ways sin manifests itself are the other side of something positive. So that to invite one's sins to dinner is to transform them into something else. So that if I use my own example, my impatience can be a manifestation of sin. But in other times, it's a sort of righteous impatience.
Right.
And to learn when one is called for and the other it shouldn't be, and there are times when to be impatient is really harmful.
Isn't verse 12 missions? Where do the missionaries go? They don't go to the faithful. They go to those who are unfaithful.
Right, and of course, there's many layers, I think, to that verse, which is obviously central to the meaning of the whole text. It's an explanation to others of what Jesus was about there and so forth. But But I am intrigued by what you say, Dan. I mean, there really is a sense in which our strengths, the opposite sides of our strengths, are often the very things that trip us up and our limitations. Okay, just a bit more about, I don't know why this why maybe I'm pushing on this, but I do think it's a critical issue. What does it mean to invite, you know, what does it mean to include a real sense of our sinfulness and our understanding of who we are? I guess I'm asking the question because my assumption is that generally our natural inclination is to exclude it or bury it or deny it or not want to deal with it. Yeah.
I've been talking a lot, but I think somehow one of the things that comes to mind is that it puts you in the company of everybody when you do that.
Right.
And the most striking example I can think of on this, because it was really hit home for me, was that in the congregation that we were in before we moved to Massachusetts, one of the youth of that congregation, 2 years older than my daughter, literally was a party to the ritual murder of a couple of elderly men in this rural community.
Wow.
And, you know, he was not the instigator of the two young men who did it, and but it was the experience of the congregation. We'd actually already moved to Massachusetts, but the experience of the congregation is one you get up on Sunday morning and you read this tale of this thing, or on Saturday and you read the tale of they found these bodies and this horrible thing that happened, and then you go to read the Sunday paper right before you go to church, and the person that is charged is one of the children who's been in the Sunday school class.
Yeah.
Okay. He's now in jail, and he will be quite possibly for his entire life. But I don't think there was anything that hit that congregation more in terms of it's easy to say we're all sinners.
Right.
But in fact.
Right.
You know, this is sort of like Judd's. Are there the real ones still? You know, are there still the ones that we aren't a part of? Are there still the things that we wouldn't, that are so far beyond the pale that it's a different category? And I think we tend to do that in our light talk. And I think the other one that came up is in my book reading group, we read 1,000 Acres, Jane Smiley's book, and I heartily commend it to any of you who have not read this book. And
especially if you're from Iowa.
Yeah. But anywhere, particularly out of our cultures, though, with the agrarian chunk of it. And in there, the main character does something that is otherwise unthinkable.
Yeah.
I will leave it at that, because otherwise it sort of gives away a lot of stuff. But it's, and I think there's something important, if we're going to get into this easy stuff, if it's not going to be easy stuff of sort of inviting in your little sins to spend time with you, you've got to recognize the way in which that your little ones are in fact in the same company with the big ones,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that they're not easy, that it's not an easy task to bring them to dinner somehow.
Right.
And I don't want to say then they're all the same or not make judgments, but that somehow in a real way you've got to identify with the whole human. It's almost as if we let the human race in, that we would, you know, some of us have committed adultery or some of us have done these things, but that somehow once we've gotten the company in, you don't then stop and say, oh, but, you know, this young man over here still doesn't come into the dinner.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's really important, that sense that to recognize one's own sins makes it much harder to separate ourselves from other people's. And my experience of that was training to work in a battered women's shelter and listening to many of the other people say, well, I'd never do this. Of course, I'd never do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't imagine how they couldn't imagine. And, you know, that was before I lived with a child. I have a very happy baby who hardly ever cries. But sometimes he doesn't, and you think, well, why won't we stop? And I couldn't imagine how these people couldn't imagine that they might, yes, sometimes get so angry that they would hit someone, no matter how much you don't want to. And I thought it was sort of a failure of imagination, but also I think it's a failure to recognize our own sinfulness, and then to extrapolate from, well, no, I've never hit anyone in anger, but I have said some pretty cutting things.
Okay, now to pick up on something you said, Deanne, was the switch and bait. or bait and switch, right?
Bait and switch.
Yeah.
Switch and bait is like fishing.
It seems to me that because of this act of Jesus inviting in these sinners, that he creates a possibility for transformation that wasn't there before. Interestingly enough, not only probably for the sinners, but also for all these other people who are kind of watching this go on and trying to figure out what in the world Jesus is doing. And they say, what are you doing? And then Jesus responds with verse 12, right? But let's take that into our own situation in our own lives. You know, if you're willing, what... I don't quite know how to ask the question, but what can get transformed, or why is there the possibility of something being transformed, or how can the person be different if you're willing to invite the sinner to dinner, or in your own personal case, name the struggles of your own life, as opposed to just letting them wander out there, or be out there, or deny that they exist, or have nothing to do with this, do with them. It seems to me that Jesus really sets up a situation here where a whole bunch of new things can happen. And, you know, you could almost see these people that are watching this as a dimension of yourself, too. I mean, that's also an interesting question. You say, who are those people, you know, that are kind of watching this going on and questioning the whole thing? And what's that dimension of you, personally, you know, as these sinners are named and invited into to dinner? Well, any responses to that? What can get transformed if we're really willing to acknowledge, those, you know, difficult dimensions of our own lives?
I don't think this is what you're getting at, Scott, but I'm going to say. Because I agree, and I think we need to talk about what it means for the sins that are from our own sinfulness.
Right.
But I also think it's important to think about the way the sin that is lodged in the world affects us.
Okay.
And I find that when there are ways that affects me, when people I work with, for example, are hurtful,
okay,
that if I can step back and think about that in theological categories, and not to say that action was itself sin, but just to acknowledge that sin is manifest in our religion, reduces my anger about it. It doesn't make me say, oh yes, this is all right, I don't have to do anything about it. But my approach to it is much different if I can look at these people with whom I'm having conflicts,
yeah,
and who I think, you know, in some situations, are being unfair,
right,
and I feel like I'm the one who sinned against,
right,
and nonetheless to say, gee, this is about sin, and everyone has sin, and these people have sin, and I have sin, and now let me at least, even though we can't talk about it together that way, I can see it. That's very freeing for me.
Yeah, that is kind of a way of naming it, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, as opposed to just trying to shoot it down or run from it.
Right, and I still have to do the sort of political things that are required,
right,
but it reduces the intensity of it somehow.
Yeah.
I think the possibility of seeing whole new, or of a whole new vision, of whole new categories, of whole new sets of expectations comes. I mean, if we, you know, go back to that text here where Jesus ate with the tax collectors and the sinners, those are people who knew that they were sinners.
Right.
I mean, there was no ambiguity about it. They weren't pretending not to be. It's not that they weren't nice enough folk, probably, but that wasn't the issue. The issue was that there were those who were righteous and the rest were sinners, and everybody knew who everybody was. And here was Jesus eating at table with these people who would have had no expectation of that. And of course, Matthew left everything and followed him. I mean, that was, for him, it was profound. And I guess I see myself as more like the Pharisees, that you know, I kind of pretend that I'm not a sinner. And as much as I do that, you know, my own resistance closes my vision to those new possibilities.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's even the implication, I mean, there's a piece in that that's this, I was reading that, and April told us read what comes afterwards, so I'm reading what comes afterwards. Mm-hmm. There's a piece that's almost the affirmation of the sinner over opposed to the Pharisee. I mean, we kind of gloss over all of those. I mean, we don't spend a lot of time on the difficulty of getting through the eye of the needle of the rich man, and we kind of gloss over those because we're so much in, what's the word today? Social location. But we, because we are so much like the Pharisees, we now come up with this kind of nice one that everybody's in, mm-hmm. right? Where there's a piece of this that said, I didn't come. I mean, literally didn't come for you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? I mean, I think that Scott was talking earlier about who's the person, the part of yourself that's on the outside looking at this happen.
Right.
Well, that's even really more jarring if you're the piece of yourself that's on the outside looking at this happen, and Jesus turns to you and says, you didn't come for the well.
Yeah.
I came for these folks over here. If you didn't find yourself as the well, then there's no, I'm over here. I'm not over there. I mean, we tend to gloss over that because we don't want that piece to be in there.
Yeah.
We don't want there to be division.
There's a beautiful line in this psalm that speaks to that. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the whole world is mine and all that is in it. I think that's kind of turning it on there.
Yeah.
Just eating with Jesus. Why is, yeah. is Jesus hungry?
I think in most cases, now there's always exceptions, but in most cases, our sinful acts are also golden in the sense that they have a lot to teach us. And if we position ourselves as being unblemished or pure, then we can't include them. There's nothing Jesus can do for us. I've always liked, you know, I grew up with this phrase, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. And then someplace along the line, somebody told me that there was another text that was more appropriately translated, be all-inclusive. I've never been able to find that, but I guess it exists somewhere. And, you know, it was kind of like some light bulbs went off for me at that point. Be all inclusive as God is all inclusive, and in other words, I know that this is true because I know this is true psychologically, that if we can include our destructive sides, or even ways in which we have been destructed, sinned against, in our understanding of ourselves, that there really is possibilities for transformation that are not there if we have to always eschew those or always hold them at arm's length. Now, one thing I'd like to ask this morning, too, I would, you know, as Christians, we say, of course, this is, our other text today work on this theme, too. We say that God's grace that is known to us through Jesus Christ and incarnated in Jesus Christ has and continues to save us from our sin, or free us from the bondage of our sins. What does that mean to you? You know, that's a pretty pivotal notion in our faith. What does that mean? What does that really mean to you? Kind of on an operational level. Or in an intellectual, any level. What comes to you when you hear that? I mean, you hear that over and over again. You hear that preached. You hear that. You've been taught that. Or would you say it differently?
I would say it makes me brave. Because I know that those things, you know, what I said before, I don't think my sinfulness ever goes away.
Okay.
But I'm not captive to it. Always there, but I don't have to be afraid that it's going to win out.
So one thing we're not saying as Christians is that through Jesus, through God's redemptive activity in Jesus, our sin all went away. And all goes away. It's just that we can get beyond it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, and I think it's always lurking, like the lion ready to devour, right? But that, you know, I guess in a way for me, Scott, sin is manifested often in imperfection and inability to do what should be done. But knowing that I'm freed from my sin means I'm not stuck in it. It's, you know, it's like maybe walking across mud or something, that I know I'm not going to get stuck in it, so I can go. You know, I'm not afraid to walk across a bog because I'm not going to sink totally into it.
I think there's a powerful image of the meal in this text, and if we, I know for myself that I've inherited a lot of, you know, thinking in terms of sinfulness and all this is the goal is to try to be perfect, you know, and confess my sin and stuff, but that's not what it's about here in the text. What the goal is to sit at the table with Jesus. And you know, it's like up here, you know, the best part about holding there the meals, I think, has been my experience so far. And we all come in and we sit together and, you know, so I get embarrassed because you didn't show up for a dish crew and your name gets read off, but yet we still are at table together. And those sins really, yeah, next time you'll show up, but we still are at table. And there's that overpowering sense that rather than worrying about, you know, about getting myself all right, or like Rulon talked about the other day, spending my energy pretending that I'm all right, we can just go ahead and say the blessing and break bread together.
There's a preliminary to the Last Supper, and the sinner needs to break bread more than the pure.
Yeah. And the power of breaking bread together is incredible. I mean, people who are holding sins against each other cannot sit down and eat together. And I've done that as a kind of counseling technique, working with some families, you know, and then having just a little to eat together. And when you finally got to the point that we could eat together, there had been some healing.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a critical point too, because what we know, what we say, what we think often, I think, are different than how we feel and how we act. And I mean, you know, we all grow up with the knowledge that we're both sinner and saint, right? But somehow we want to chop off the first part of that and operate mostly on the other side rather than holding them together. You know, there isn't anybody that I've ever asked, are you a sinner, that would say, said, no, I'm not a sinner. And yet, it really surprises them when they discover they are.
Yeah. But I'm better than most other people.
I mean, we...
It's a metal bag.
You see, we're all complex. I mean, we can say one thing, but then, you know, when our... We don't like our name right off, that we missed the dish team.
Even
I do think there are better ways to do that, but I mean, we don't. When we come face to face with our sin, we're surprised. We're surprised. Even though we've been saying all our life, "I'm a sinner," right?
And in that way, Mission right. Missing Dish Team is a good example because no one does it on purpose.
No. Right.
No one thinks, gee, I have dish team, I think I'll go on a hike. Other people, right. And I know it's a really bad meal, yeah. You know, there's a lot of cheese stuck on the pan, so I don't want to do it, I think I'll go on a hike.
Right.
No one does that.
Yeah, no, they don't. Not around. I mean, these are, you know, responsible people that come from the village. It's that they don't look at the list or they forget, I mean, or something, you know.
Or yeah. Someone asked them to do some other job.
Yeah, and they got sidetracked, or, yeah. Got into a conversation, forgot about
it. Yes.
So I think getting into our psyche somehow, this, it's really, and then I'm, you know, and then Matthew adds this. We need to quit here, but verse 13, he adds this quote from Hosea 6:6. How does it feel? Do mercy and not sorry.
Mercy, not sorry.
Yeah. And I was intrigued by what you said. I don't know, was it you, Linda, or you, Indiana? About, you know, there is a sense in which it's maybe like AA. You know, they say that unless you know the people that are most effective dealing with alcoholics are former alcoholics or people that have worked through that whole recovery process themselves. And there is something to that, isn't it? I mean, you're more able to deal with others and their limitations if you come to terms with your own as well, I think. And so mercy is more of a possibility. Now, of course, this also probably refers to the fact that the righteous were the ones who routinely did their sacrifices faithfully. And so it's a sort of comment on that.
Well, yeah, and of course Jesus as a rabbi was eating with people who hadn't done the sacrifices right, weren't clean. I mean, his disciples were not washing their hands before they ate.
Right.
And the whole thing was that they weren't prepared in the right ways.
Right.
Oh, I was also struck with the third time. I mean, just to come back on something, there is something that needs the sacrificial aspect, or at least in one sense of mythology does, because even though we get these two, we get the brackets where you don't need the sacrifice, and smack in the middle, you get the text which says, because God has made this, the sacrifice has been made. It's not really that there's no sacrifice anymore.
Just that it's not your job.
It's not your job to do the sacrifice anymore. I mean, the text is, this is imputed to you because the sacrifice has been made, not that somehow sacrifices.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah, in Romans.
In the Romans text, because I was the one reading that probably.
You mean because this is being, of course, written from a post?
Post, yeah. But it strikes me that it isn't, that if we're going to hold on to myths, there is...